From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, WorldCom, Enron, Tyco, Arthur Andersen, Adelphia. Why are so many companies going down at the same time? We discuss the string of corporate scandals with financial investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Adult World, the new solo album by 50-something guitarist and vocalist Wayne Kramer, formerly of the MC5. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A corporate reform bill is now ready for President Bush to sign into law, as he says he intends to do. The legislation passed overwhelmingly today in both houses of Congress. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The bill passed unanimously in the Senate and 423-3 in the House, where Republican Michael Oxley, who chaired efforts to draft the final bill, called it a victory.
Bottom line here is the American people have won. We have restored, and we're beginning to restore investor confidence with what we've done.
Oxley stressed the stiffer criminal penalties that House Republicans added to the Senate's accounting industry reforms. But House Democrat Lloyd Doggett of Texas said many Americans have little to celebrate.
For those who labored in their jobs and find themselves jobless, this success comes a little too late. They can't even afford the champagne cork to pop.
Both Democrats and Republicans warn the corporate reforms are not a panacea, but both parties rushed to pass the bill with public outrage over corporate fraud at a peak and elections looming next fall. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Bush used a visit to a North Carolina hospital today to highlight his support for legislation that would limit medical malpractice awards. The president favors a cap on the amount that malpractice victims can win in court, saying it would hold down insurance costs that keep doctors from working in high-risk specialties. The president supports legislation now pending in Congress that would limit the pain and suffering portion of malpractice awards to $250,000. The measure would limit punitive damage awards to $250,000, or twice the amount of the patient's actual financial loss. Mr. Bush said the legislation would reduce the nation's health care bill by $60 billion. Critics say the limits would benefit the insurance industry at the expense of malpractice victims. Workers are drilling on a 30-inch hole that rescue crews hope will allow them to free 9 trapped coal miners in southwestern Pennsylvania. But the rescuers aren't expected to reach the trapped miners until at least tomorrow morning. Mark Newtbar reports from member station WDUQ.
Officials say the miners accidentally broke through to an abandoned mine, releasing millions of gallons of water. The 9 men have gone to a high spot in the mine where an air pocket was created. A 6-inch hole has been drilled, and high-pressure air is being pumped in to increase the size of that air pocket. Dan Sacco of the state special medical response team says the miners are fighting more than just rising water.
Hypothermia, also the possibility of having to be decompressed because of the pressure.
Additional holes are being drilled and water is being pumped from the mine to make rescue efforts easier. For NPR News, I'm Mark Newtbar in Somerset, Pennsylvania.
In stocks, the Nasdaq lost 50 points or 3.8% to close at 1,240. The Dow lost 5 points to close at 8,186. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft is defending the administration's Operation TIPS proposal, which is designed to get more Americans watching out for possible terrorist activity. Members of Congress voiced concern today that the program might lead Americans to spy on their neighbors. Ashcroft said the program was created after several industries asked for a systematic way of reporting suspicious activity. Now that James Traficant has been expelled from the U.S. House of Representatives, his Ohio constituents will be without a representative for 5 months. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
There could have been a special election to pick someone to finish Traficant's term, but Ohio's governor has decided against it. Republican Bob Taft says it would require a special primary and a special general election, and that would cost $800,000. Taft adds the process would take at least a couple months, and by the time the temporary fill-in took a seat in Congress, there'd probably be only a month left before adjournment.
From a practical standpoint, after you conducted a primary and a general, you know, how long would a person actually be able to serve in that unexpired term?
Residents of the Youngstown area district in Northeast Ohio will pick a new representative in November at the regular election. The winner will take office for a full two-year term in January. There are four candidates, and running as an independent, Traficant is one of them. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Firefighters in California say they've managed to keep a 57,000-acre wildfire away from several ancient groves of giant sequoia trees. About 1,500 firefighters are working to contain the blaze in the giant sequoia national monument. Authorities are holding a Bakersfield woman who's accused of starting the fire. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's newspaper headlines brought more bad news of what's gone wrong in corporate America. The founder of the cable company Adelphia was arrested with his two sons, who are former executives, on charges of looting the company of more than $1 billion and using it as a personal piggy bank. And AOL's accounting practices are now being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. In its attempt to end this kind of bad news, yesterday a joint House-Senate committee approved a measure to overhaul corporate fraud, accounting, and securities laws. My guest Kurt Eichenwald is a financial investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's covered corporate fraud for the past 15 years. Lately, he's been focusing on Enron, Arthur Andersen, and WorldCom. I asked him what the proposed legislation might accomplish.
Well, probably the biggest hope is that it's going to get some of the concerns that are in the marketplace about the reliability of the financial numbers that are being put out, get some of that concern calmed down so that the market can get back on track, that people can begin to assess companies based on their actual values, and we can move on. The reality of that, how they're going to go about doing it, is basically they're stepping up a series of enforcement mechanisms. We now have some fairly strict enforcement procedures. What we have found out that we don't have is particularly good oversight. Up from the 1930s until now, there's been a huge reliance on the integrity of accountants, the integrity of corporate officers to truthfully represent their financial positions. What has happened over the last number of years is that far too many of those folks have been figuring out ways to get closer and closer to the line and sometimes over the line in ways that ultimately misrepresent the true nature of a company's financial performance. So what this legislation would accomplish is stepping up the dangers of doing that, stepping up the potential criminal penalties, for example, that a corporate officer or an accountant would face for crossing the line. It also would set up an oversight board for the accounting industry, which, you know, there has been many, many weeks of debate about how much power that group should actually have. But ultimately, it's going to serve, once this is signed, it's going to serve as a new check on the accounting industry, and one that can be used almost as a good housekeeping seal of approval. So that, along with stepped-up budget for the SEC and other actions, are certainly going to make the oversight functions of our securities laws and our corporate laws much stronger.
So if we can't rely on the conscience of the accountants and the corporate heads, we're at least hoping that the fear of punishment will keep them in line.
It's a sad commentary on where we are, but that's exactly it. I mean, one of the disturbing elements of the last few months is not that it's come out that corporations were doing things that were illegal. It's the things that they were doing that were in fact legal that completely misrepresented their financial condition. Those have created too many incentives for people who are particularly clever to wheedle their way around the rules and put out financial statements that are not representative of the companies. But they have, in fact, followed each rule to the letter, ultimately undermining the spirit of the legislation. And hopefully that kind of behavior, when you increase the punishments for being cute, is going to be a little bit less tempting.
The founder of Adelphia and two of his sons have just been arrested, accused of looting the company and using it as their personal piggy bank. Is it any coincidence that so many big companies are going down at the same time?
No. This is not surprising. This is the consequence of having years of a market bubble. What happens in those circumstances, time and time again, whether it's in a sector or the entire market, is that corporate executives and investors start to think that the rules of business and investing have changed. They start to think that basically they can get away with pretty much anything, that you can invest in a stock on Monday, sell it on Wednesday, and you'll make money and you can do it forever, that corporate executives believe they can partake of the cash of a company and the company will do just fine because it's been doing so well in the past. And besides, look at our stock price. Ultimately, the bubble pops. And when the bubble pops, it splatters a lot of people. And that's what we have here. Everybody was getting loose. Everybody was getting comfortable. Everybody was getting greedy, all of us. And the consequences of that are going to play out for a while.
You recently wrote a piece asking, now that capitalism has won over communism, can capitalism survive the capitalists? What do you mean by that question?
It's something I've always found fascinating, that the first people to step up to argue against capitalism tend to be the capitalists themselves. Capitalism, the fundamental concept of it, is those who produce the best product at the lowest price win. When people start to lose, they run to Washington. They ask for trade sanctions. They ask for all sorts of other actions. Now, I'm not saying that those are always wrong, but frequently they're being put in place because a company simply can't cut it. In this instance, what we have are capitalists going for excised profits, capitalists going for profits beyond what the market would give to them if they weren't trying to fool the market. And to me, that is far more damaging to capitalism than anything else. Capitalism requires that people have some fundamental bedrock of faith that the system is functioning, that companies are working and putting out numbers, and the numbers they're putting out are reflective of what the companies are doing, and therefore they're able to take this risk of investing. If it becomes much more of a crapshoot, if it becomes, well, these numbers are a guesstimate of what actually might be happening, I have no way of knowing, you're going to see what's been happening. You're going to see people pulling their money out of the markets and putting it on the sidelines until they have faith that the only risk they're taking is the risk of their investment, not the risk of fraud and the rest. That is what the capitalists have done that is undermining the system, the relentless pursuit of personal profit, the relentless pursuit of higher stock prices when the market is telling them it's not working anymore. That's where these kinds of frauds come out of, and that's the damage to the system.
Kurt Eichenwald is my guest. He's a financial investigative reporter for the New York Times. He covers corporate fraud and has been doing that for about 15 years. Corporate fraud is nothing new. I don't have to tell you that. But is there anything that holds all these recent corporate and accounting scandals together, anything in the techniques or the style that makes these scandals any different from earlier ones?
Well, what's interesting about this one, which you didn't have in things like the insider trading scandals of the 1980s or the savings and loan scandals, what's interesting about this one is what we've witnessed is a complete breakdown of the checks and balances of the corporate oversight system. The accountants failed, the boards failed, the institutional investors who are supposed to be playing a role in overseeing corporate governance failed. The SEC failed. The Congress failed. It's many of these issues have been presented to the Congress, and they listened to the words of the industries and said, no, we don't need to make any changes. So a lot of the outrage you're seeing these days on Capitol Hill is a consequence of, you know, them hoping that people don't realize how much of this, these probabilities of these events happening have already been presented to them, and they sidestepped it. So that breakdown is different than anything else, because we're not just seeing the consequence of greed. We can deal with that. We've dealt with that in the past. We will deal with that forever. What we're seeing is a consequence of sloth. In other words, people stopped caring. Investors stopped caring. Boards stopped caring. Wall Street stopped caring. Analysts stopped caring. Accountants stopped caring. All anybody wanted was for the stock price to go up for the next day. And when you have that as the single overriding factor, regardless of how it's done, this is the consequence. We haven't seen something on this scale with this much significance since the late 1920s. And the 1930s played out with the same kind of information coming out, the level of arrogance, the level of recklessness, the level of just plain fundamental criminal activity going on in corporate America. And out of that grew the decision to establish the Securities and Exchange Commission so we could have some oversight of the markets. Clearly, it's time for those types of oversights to be stepped up again.
Well, meanwhile, Harvey Pitt, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, is asking that his position be elevated to a cabinet position and that the position be given a raise in salary as well. A lot of people are laughing, thinking like, oh, what a ridiculous time for the head of the SEC to be asking for a raise. But what would it mean if that position was elevated to a cabinet position?
That everyone in Washington had left town except for Harvey Pitt. I don't mean that to belittle him. Harvey Pitt is actually a brilliant man. He is one of the smartest securities lawyers out there. But he came in with not a good message. When he began, his message was kinder, friendlier SEC. The chairman who preceded him, Arthur Levitt, was very aggressive. But now it's coming out that Arthur Levitt was very right. He was saying that there needed to be significant reforms in the accounting industry. He lost on that. He has said publicly that that's his single biggest regret, is that he backed down on that. When Harvey Pitt started saying kinder, gentler, it wasn't too long after that that these scandals started. And he had a little bit of delay in shifting his position, in getting into the point of recognizing the magnitude of what was going on, and also understanding that he was now in somewhat of a political position, and that his words had different meaning than they might have if he was still back at his offices at Freed Frank. So I'd say if he didn't get it before, he gets it now. But I think the smartest thing for him to do is not to elevate his position anymore, not to try and draw attention to himself, because he is somewhat of a lightning rod right now, fair or not. And he instead should just be the chairman of the SEC, do that job, work at it aggressively, recognize that right now he is one of the single most important government officials in Washington right now. He's certainly the one that's attracting the most attention as people wait to see what he's going to do next. And I think the proof is in the pudding. He trying to counter the criticism is not necessarily effective, but going off and doing the job is.
My guest is financial investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the string of corporate scandals that have shaken America. My guest, Kurt Eichenwald, is an investigative financial reporter for The New York Times. He's covered corporate fraud for 15 years. Do me a favor, just run through a list for us of some of the investigations underway right now in the corporate world.
It'll take the rest of the hour. you have Enron, which, of course, is now the granddaddy of them all, even though it started in October. That is both criminal and civil, both SEC and criminal case. You have Adelphia, which is both SEC and, as everyone knows, since the Regas family was arrested, is criminal. You have WorldCom. You have Tyco. You have Martha Stewart. I've always looked on that as sort of the People magazine portion of the of the corporate fraud scandals. You had Anderson, but Anderson is now dying. It'll be gone by next month.
I mean, the whole company will be gone by next month.
They're not going to be doing any. They're not going to be auditing any public companies after August 14th. Mm-hmm. I think it is,
mm-hmm.
And that's. I mean, that's the death of an accounting firm. You have Dynegy. You have. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on and on and on. You have Quest, which is out in Denver, which is now under criminal investigation by the U.S. attorney out there. You have Xerox. Now that one is just an SEC case. But that was already settled, but they've had problems with their accounting. And what we're really seeing is both the problems that I described earlier of the dirty little secrets that have been going on coming out, and now a lack of tolerance for games playing, a lack of tolerance for things that come close to the line but clearly result in misrepresentations of financial statements. And it's spreading rather widely.
Let's zoom in on one of the stories you've been covering, which is WorldCom. WorldCom filed for bankruptcy this week. It's the largest bankruptcy in history. What does bankruptcy mean for a company like WorldCom?
Bankruptcy was almost beside the point. I mean, once it was known the level of the accounting fraud, and at WorldCom it is accounting fraud that took place, that company was dead. And these discussions about would they go into bankruptcy or wouldn't they, to me, were on par with, you know, is the sun going to come up tomorrow? It might not, but in all probability it will. Bankruptcy, the effect of the bankruptcy at WorldCom is actually bigger on the other telecom companies, which is sort of a weird side effect. In bankruptcy, it doesn't mean you're out of business. It means that your debts and obligations are put on hold. You no longer have to pay them, and then a negotiation is reached with creditors, and you pay a certain amount on the dollar, or you give them stock in a new company, or you sell off pieces of the company and use that to pay them back, something along those lines. What that does is now WorldCom's biggest expenses, among their biggest expenses, their debt expenses, are gone. They don't have to pay them. Other competing telecom companies that aren't in bankruptcy do. So suddenly their flexibility is freed up. They are in a better position today than they were last week. And they're in a markedly better competitive position today than some of their competitors are. But the flip side of that is that the creditors control the company. The people who are owed the money have a lot of say over what goes on from now on. And WorldCom's not going to emerge from bankruptcy as some giant behemoth that controls the world. It's probably going to be split up into its component parts.
So who are the creditors that are going to be fighting with each other about the destiny of WorldCom, and who gets paid first?
That's what a bankruptcy is all about, is figuring out that list and figuring out who gets the biggest say. I mean, the banks are going to be the first in line. That's Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and General Electric Capital. Those three are the ones that are providing it financing on an ongoing basis. They're giving them up to $2 billion, and they get paid first because that's debtor-in-possession financing. Those banks as well and other banks are lenders to WorldCom, and they are owed money going forward. Everyone from the Wall Street firms that provided securities underwriting to the guy who stocked the candy machine at the WorldCom headquarters in Clinton, Mississippi, is a creditor, is somebody who's owed money. And all of them are owed different amounts. It's the ones that are owed the most, the banks, that tend to have the most influence over the creditors' committee as you go forward in bankruptcy.
Kurt Eichenwald covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the now bankrupt WorldCom. We continue our conversation with Kurt Eichenwald. He covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Adult World, the new solo album by Wayne Kramer, formerly of the MC5. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with financial investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. Lately, he's been occupied with Enron, Arthur Andersen, and WorldCom. I'm sure a lot of people already understand this, but can you briefly describe the nature of the WorldCom fraud?
Sure. WorldCom on some level is a little bit boring because unlike Enron, which has just endless wheels within wheels within wheels of accounting manipulations, WorldCom is simply, you know, we took money from here and we put it over there. What they did is every year companies spend money for the purpose of producing their products. That money is an operating expense. An operating expense would be salaries for employees or the costs of delivering something, so things like that. Every company has them. There are also capital costs, and I'll try not to get technical. Capital costs is like big machinery, something that you buy, that you use for a long time, that decreases in value over time. Under accounting rules, you're allowed to take a capital expense, and rather than taking it all up front, rather than saying, okay, I just spent $300 million on building a new factory, I have to charge that against my earnings this year, what you're allowed to do is say, well, we're going to use this factory for 30 years. So we will take the cost, divide it up by 30, and charge that against our expenses year after year after year. So rather than charging $300 million, you charge $10 million. A very common way of committing fraud is to take the operating expenses that occur every year and call them capital expenses. So you only have to charge a tiny percentage of the amount against your earnings. That's what WorldCom did. I hope I didn't confuse anybody. They shifted expenses that should have been counted each year into another account that allowed them to play those expenses out over many, many years. The total amount that they didn't declare was $3.8 billion. That makes a huge impact on the actual financial performance of the company.
And were the numbers manipulated just enough so that they can meet their profit expectations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing that I found out about this that I thought was fascinating was that if you look for, you know, the number is $3.8 billion. Well, anytime you move money around in a corporation, there's got to be documentation for why you did that. If you move $100, there's got to be a receipt or something for why that money moved. Well, they moved $3.8 billion, and there was no documentation backing up how they arrived at those numbers. Why 3.8? Why not 3.9? Why not 6.2? Why not 1.7? The numbers seemed completely arbitrary. But then when you go backwards and you look at what their financial performance was and the profit margin that they were promising Wall Street they were going to make, and you look at what they did each and every quarter, the amount they shifted matched exactly what they would need to reduce their expenses by in order to hit the profit margins that they were promising Wall Street. That is the kind of evidence of fraud that is huge for a prosecutor, because what it demonstrates is a knowing intent to deceive. You know, you can't say, well, you know, I was moving the money for a reason other than hitting this target, when there's no other documentation and you keep hitting the target every single quarter.
Right. And where do the accountants come in the WorldCom scandal?
That's a really good question. One of the things that's sort of the most unnerving about WorldCom is, again, we're not talking about something that's sophisticated. We're not talking about something that's gray or that, you know, different minds might disagree on whether it's appropriate. It's completely inappropriate. It's just plain vanilla fraud that you see on much smaller scales all the time. This is the kind of thing that auditors are supposed to look at. They're supposed to find documentation for capital expenses. They're supposed to look at what is called a journal entry. When a transfer is made, it has to be written down somewhere, and that's done in what's called a journal entry. Well, the accountants are holding up their hands saying, well, the management lied to us. What are we supposed to do? I'm not an auditing expert. A lot of the auditors I speak to say that's ridiculous, that obviously they should have caught it. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say, well, you know, they couldn't have caught it. Well, then there's something wrong with the system. Then there's something wrong with how we do audits in this company, in this country. Because if you can't catch a $3.8 billion fraud that is as simple and unsophisticated as the WorldCom fraud was, then audits are a joke, and shareholders shouldn't have to pay for them.
What are some of the suggestions of how the system should be changed?
There are brighter minds than mine that are coming through with solutions. I actually think one of the things that seems very, very minor, but I actually love, is this idea of having the chief executives and chief financial officers sign that, to the best of their knowledge, the financial statements are fair reflection of the corporation's performance. Lots of executives are whining and moaning about having to do that, which I find fascinating. It's like all you're saying is that the information you're putting out is true and to the best of their knowledge. And I think that people are very frightened to sign that. And I think, good, they should be frightened. Fear is a very great motivating factor to keep you away from the line. And that's really what we're talking about. How do you keep people away from the line? I think the accounting review board, you know, again, this is a proof in the pudding situation, but the accounting review board, if they actually act with teeth, on this new legislation, if they perform an actual function, could be very good in keeping accountants in line. But ultimately, I think one thing that will help in this scenario is the lessons of the marketplace. I mean, we didn't have this happen 10 years ago. I had to go back to the 1920s to find a scenario that was similar to this, where people were putting out numbers that were just bogus. In this situation, people are going to jail, companies are going under, people are losing their jobs, and by this I mean corporate executives. More important, they're losing their reputations, they're being dragged before Congress and humiliated nationally. They're being forced to drop the aura of great men and instead answer for their incompetence or criminality. And I'm a big believer in shame. I'm a big believer that corporate executives who aren't doing it right, if they know they face the probability of or the possibility of having their greatness questioned, they're more likely to think twice about it. And so, to a lot of degrees, I'm kind of happy with the changes that are being made.
My guest is financial investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kurt Eichenwald is my guest. He's a financial investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he specializes in corporate fraud, and he's a very busy man nowadays. You've been covering the Enron story, WorldCom, and Arthur Andersen. I'm just wondering what it's been like for you to sit through the trials and to witness up close this kind of corporate fraud. Maybe what's been most striking about it to you?
The most striking thing is
how surprised everybody is.
I mean, for me, it's sort of been years of howling in the wind. I mean, I have seen fraud after fraud after fraud after fraud, and then watch Washington stand up and, you know, congressmen pound the table and say, well, there's just too much enforcement and there are too many lawsuits and we really have to protect corporations. Now, bear in mind, I think American corporations, for the most part, do a great job. But there's a lot of money there, and money attracts criminals. And money attracts sleazy people. And, you know, like Reagan used to say, trust but verify. I mean, you have to be able to verify what's going on. This is only a surprise to the extent of how much people are surprised. And, you know, a couple of years ago when the market was booming and booming and booming, I was talking to my wife and I said, you know, I'm going to be really busy in a year or two. Because you could just look at it and say, you know that something's going on. The tide's going to go out. And when it does, you're going to see all the litter that was brought up. And that's where we are. And I didn't imagine it would be as rapid fire as it's been. I thought it would play out over a longer period of time. But, the fact that this is happening is merely a statement that it has always been happening and it'll always happen again. And what we have to do is make sure that we protect the marketplace, we have the rules in place to protect the marketplace, and stop writing enforcement rules to the needs of the honest executives. We have to recognize there are dishonest executives out there.
Do you have any favorite moments from the recent fraud trials that you've sat through?
I do. I mean, one of the stranger moments was when Arthur Andersen was putting on its defense, and against document destruction for impeding investigations, and the fellow testifying on cross examination began saying, "Well, of course we destroy documents to keep them out of the hands of plaintiffs' lawyers because they're just going to misrepresent them, and if we don't destroy them, they'll misrepresent them, and everyone will misrepresent them." And it's there going, "Boy, now we know why." The sense of arrogance. Like, if you're in this industry, I know plaintiffs' lawyers can go too far. I know government can go too far. I know regulators can go too far. But the problem is, you don't want them going not too far. It's better that they go too far and make it a little harder for everybody else and make things, you know, a little bit more involved, rather than having what has happened here happen, rather than having the bad guys slip through the cracks and the entire marketplace pay the price.
I wonder if there's any editorial guidelines that regulate how a financial investigative reporter like yourself at the New York Times can invest. You know, are there any editorial guidelines for your personal investing, since you are covering these people and, you know, might conceivably have inside information?
Pages and pages and pages. We have an entire policy that is very, very aggressive. I am not allowed to invest in any individual stock. I am not allowed to invest in a sector fund, for instance. I can't do anything that allows me to in any way profit off of anything I write. Now, there are times when it works the other way. I was invested in a stock fund in 1997 that had as its single highest holding Columbia HCA, which I found out about 3 weeks before I wrote. I had a 4,000-word story on the front page that said that Columbia was riddled with fraud and was and in the end it cost them billions of dollars and the management got thrown out, and, you know, I probably lost money. But, you know, in the end, people who cover AT&T have to have a phone. I have to be able to put money somewhere. And so I'm allowed to do things where I can't individually profit or off of directions of stocks or sectors.
And do you miss being able to do that, or are you just as happy?
Well, the thing is, if I wasn't covering the stuff I was covering, I wouldn't know as much as I do about how to invest.
Right.
So I would be allowed to invest, but then I wouldn't know anything. So in a way, I think I'm probably better off.
Right.
Because I can make broad decisions. You know, I want to get out of the market now, or I want to reduce my exposure to the market now, or I want to increase my exposure to the market now. And, you know, those are actually good enough. I do just fine.
I don't mean to imply that you would be enjoying things at the expense of everybody else who is suffering right now, but has it been interesting for you to cover these stories and to be as widely read as you are now? A lot of people often might skip over the financial story, but right now it's like the main event for a lot of people.
I would be lying if I said I didn't enjoy it. The one thing that I think is actually, I actually think this whole period is very, very healthy. I know a lot of people are suffering. I know a lot of people are having trouble, but we kind of have to look at it from the long-term perspective. This is the culmination of problems that I have been seeing year in and year out in corporate America. And I would write about it, and very, very little would change. And I would be in the homes of blind little old ladies who, in fact, had lost their homes. I would see families who had been ruined. I would see people year after year after year who had their faith in this country and in this system wrecked by corporate fraud. But it never rose to the level of people saying, you know, this is really bad. Now you're seeing the culmination of that lack of attention. You're seeing everybody recognizing how bad it is, how damaging it is. And in a way, it seems like it had to get this bad until it finally attracted somebody's attention. Lots of changes are being made. In the long run, I think it's going to be very, very healthy for this country and for this economy. I actually have much more faith in the marketplace today than I had 2 years ago when we were up at 11,000. And, you know, anybody thinking it through for a minute would probably agree with that. You know, we have greater commitment to oversight. We have greater commitment to keeping things right. We have people afraid of doing things wrong. And that's reality. If you puff up the numbers and fake the numbers and we all make money, it's all going to come to an end someday. So I'm very, very sorry that so many people had to be hurt in order for us as a country to recognize both the power and damage of corporate fraud. But hopefully now that everyone's attention is riveted to it, and Congress is willing to do something about it and the president is willing to do something about it, maybe we'll fix things. Maybe we'll be able to go for a decade or two without it happening again.
Well, thank you for finding an optimistic note to end on. Kurt Eichenwald, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kurt Eichenwald covers corporate fraud for the New York Times. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new solo album by Wayne Kramer, formerly of the MC5. This is Fresh Air. Wayne Kramer's career has lasted for a sizable portion of rock and roll history. As a founding member of the 60s Detroit band The MC5, Kramer has always made raucous, often political rock, as both a guitarist and vocalist. The new solo album by the 50-something Kramer is called Adult World. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
It's got a great big sound. I play it really loud. I'll never turn it down. I got a great big amp.
The MC and the MC5 stood for Motor City, the Detroit where Wayne Kramer took the inspiration to make music that would shake people out of preconceived ways of thinking. In 1969, that meant an album called Kick Out the Jams, powered not only by Kramer's guitar, but by the radical politics of John Sinclair's White Panther Party, for whom the MC5 was sort of the house band. Sinclair liked to quote the surrealist André Breton's phrase, "Revolution is poetry." These days, Wayne Kramer is espousing a different kind of poetry.
Nelson Algren stopped by last week. Chicago City with the big shoulders, he said. Hog butcher to the world, I said. Gateway to the West, huh? No, kid, that's St. Louis, he corrected me. Home of the White Sox. Boss Daly runs things round here. House of Capone. Chicago, a city on the make. Nelson, you want a sandwich, a piece of fruit or something? Nah, kid. I gotta meet the dealer in a few. Plus, the punk has a poodle for the girlfriend. Cheap.
That cut, called Nelson Algren Stop By, is a bit of jazz poetry saluting not Detroit but Chicago, home of Algren, hipster author of The Man with the Golden Arm, among many other books. Kramer has remained true to his surrealist beginnings, though. Those lines have a nicely hallucinatory stream of consciousness, which I suspect was supplied in large part by Kramer's old pal and frequent collaborator in recent years, David Was of Was Not Was. Even when he chips away at a more conventional chunk of rock, like the album's title song, Adult World, Kramer maintains a free-associating intensity.
She had a smile so big you could skywrite on it. He had a voice so deep it sounded like tires. She had hard sweater breasts and maximum thighs. He drove with one hand on her hip bone. She says, you can call me Aphrodite. Let me slip into my nightie. They were a skillful impersonation of success and living in an adult world.
Over the course of this album, Wayne Kramer offers a song disguised as a love letter from Fidel Castro deep in the jungles of Cuban Revolution, another expressing sympathy for a teenage runaway, and some piffle about the slime that ate Cleveland. Then there's really solid, if perplexing, music like Brought a Knife to the Gunfight.
Brought a knife to the gunfight. Somehow it's not enough. Walk in with a swagger, but all I do is bluff. And inside a suit of armor, come up a little short. Bought myself a ticket, forgot my passport. Brought a knife to the gunfight, and I can't even up the score. I need a secret weapon. I need a little more.
There's a woman. When the MC5 broke up in the early 70s, lead singer Rob Tyner tried his hand at being a songwriter for hire and a photographer. guitarist Fred Sonic Smith toured with Iggy Pop and then married Patti Smith, and they made beautiful music together until he died of heart failure in 1994. Wayne Kramer did time for drugs and launched the solo career that has persisted unto this album. It's a fine piece of work, one that kicks out the jams as well as anything he's done over three decades.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Adult World by Wayne Kramer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Tariq Rose.
Flying Betty Cleveland came in off the lake. Must have blown in on the winter wind when no one was awake. Flying Betty Cleveland looked at boys in his trail. Every guy sick as men and every girl
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Royal Tenenbaums is now out on video and DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from director and co-writer Wes Anderson. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.